Thank you for joining me for the first half of John 10. If you are someone who listens often, you'll notice there's been almost a couple weeks off of the podcast. But that's because I had the chance to be up at one of our Young Life camps speaking. And then this past weekend, Adam Paulson and I threw our first ever The Other Country retreat. It was so wonderful. So thank you to Becky and Quinn, you wonderful people, for having that. And thank you to all those men from Fort Collins who joined us. What a great, awesome opportunity that was. Now, before we dive into John 10, 1 through 21, it is worth noting here that before we actually even read a word, that the opening of this chapter is a continuation of what Jesus had just been saying. So the blind man had been healed, then basically put on trial. Then after he meets Jesus in the street and worships him, and then the Pharisees, overhearing one of Jesus' comments about their becoming blind, they have a short little argument with him. So before we dive in, these next words spring directly out of that same day and that same latter exchange. Perhaps just happening in the middle of some street in Jerusalem. It's kind of a cool little spot. So in the Phillips translation, here we go, John 10. Then Jesus said, "Believe me when I tell you that anyone who does not enter the sheepfold through the door, but climbs in by some other way, is a thief and a rogue. It is the shepherd of the flock who goes in by the door. It is to him the doorkeeper opens the door, and it is his voice that the sheep recognize." Now, it is also worth noting as we're diving in that these Pharisees and the rest of the crowd that's probably crowding around Jesus right now do not know that they are living in the midst of a scripture happening. Do you ever think about that? They don't know that Jesus' every word is the gospel. To them, it's just some dusty Jerusalem street on a particularly warm, I don't know, Thursday. So imagine how strange all of this must have sounded when Jesus, with absolutely no segue at all, goes from talking about blindness into this inexplicable little story about sheepfolds. Again, remember, they're not familiar with the concept of John or chapter or 10. So, instead of our familiarity with this chapter and some of its passages, let's instead approach his words with the trying to sort it outness of his listeners. So what do we actually have in these opening words? Well, we have a sheepfold, a squared or circled off section of permanent or impermanent fencing in which sheep are kept safe from their own stupidities and from outside intruders. We have a door, a small break in that fence. We have a thief and a rogue. Anyone, Jesus tells us, who is trying to sneak into the sheep by any way other than the door itself. We have the shepherd, a man or a boy whose sole purpose in life was to care for the sheep, protect the sheep, graze and water the sheep, and know them each by their number, yes, but also by their specific characteristics. We have a whole flock, which are the sheep themselves. We have the doorkeeper, one who stands at that door and whose only purpose is to act as watchman over its ingress and egress. Then we have the shepherd's voice, the particular sound and cadence and tone that the sheep have heard speak to them, shout to them, whisper to them, even sing to them, day in and day out. So can you see all those elements in your mind's eye? Picture that. Be there. All right, let's go. The shepherd calls his own sheep by name and leads them out of the fold. Stop. There's just such an intimacy, such a loveliness to that little portion of the picture. To call the sheep and lead them out, the shepherd has approached and, with a nod to that doorkeeper, entered in through the door and into the fold. The sound of his voice and the smell of his clothing causes the sheep to stir and rise. This is their shepherd come to them. You can picture him now wading through their midst, petting their heads, speaking laughingly to his favorites as they're nudging up against him, battling to be close. Then it's time to head out. He nods to the doorkeeper again, and that door opens. He begins to walk behind them at their rear, urging them out the gate. You see, he knows the eccentricities of every single one of those sheep. He combs the back of the flock, getting even the most straggling of stragglers out toward the grazing fields. Perhaps there is no better or more picturesque language in all the scripture to describe the beautiful ways of Jesus and his choosing to be incarnate and among us. It's lovely. And when he has driven all his own flock outside, he goes in front of them himself, and the sheep follow him because they know his voice. With this, there is such surety and quiet strength in this section. Having pushed and prodded and coaxed those sheep through the narrowness of the door, the shepherd then watches how they huddle outside, pressing tightly against each other for fear of the unknowns outside the fold. Can you see him striding around them, toward the side of them that faces the fields, leaning on his shepherd's staff? Then, just with a slight little whistle and a word, he himself begins to stride away toward those lush and ready grazing grounds. As one, the sheep turn. They know that voice. They know that stride. They will go where the shepherd leads with no fear at all. Perhaps there is no better or more picturesque language in all the scriptures to describe the way Jesus leads out his church in its kingdom work, with himself always at the head. The sheep will never follow a stranger. Indeed, they will run away from him, for they do not recognize strange voices. Jesus gave them this illustration, but they did not grasp the point of what he was saying to them. Which is pretty apropos, actually, since they themselves, those Pharisees, are really the strange voices he's referring to. So Jesus said to them once more, "I do assure you that I myself am the door for the sheep. All who have gone before me are like thieves and rogues, but the sheep did not listen to them. I am the door. If a man goes in through me, he will be safe and sound. He can come in and out and find his food or pasture." Now, in that last verse, this translation has made a pretty bold choice on one little Greek meaning that I think really brings to life this third of Jesus' I am statements in the book of John. Every other translation that you might be reading from or you read from in your devotional life says that those who come in by Jesus' door or gate will be, quote, saved. But in my translation, the Phillips that I just read to you, he has it, "he will be safe and sound," which truly I think is actually closer maybe to Jesus' meaning here. You see, the ones who have gone before have been those, like the Pharisees, who have split hairs over the law and have bound these people, these sheep, with a lifestyle impossible to keep up. Instinctively, the people, the sheep, haven't listened. Something in them has known that there is no life, no food to be found in that way. But here is the door. Here is the door through which we may come and go, safe and sound, be fed and find our food, our pasturage. I really believe there is less of a salvation tone in these words and more of a childlike safety, an unconcerned and trusting posture that we may actually have in Jesus. Of course, he is the Savior. But if this was one of his big salvation statements, why would people be coming in and also leaving? I think instead, if he's our source of safety and sustenance, yes, we would transit in and out through him. We would bed down within his protection. We would be led out through him to his chosen pastures for us. Then comes a famous section here. The thief comes with the sole intention of stealing and killing and destroying. Now, just like back in chapter 8, when Jesus gave us that helpful name for the evil one, the father of lies, I think he also gives us a potent weapon against the evil one here by exposing the narrowness of his activities, stealing, killing, and destroying. Yes, there may be subtleties to how the evil one attempts to do these things, but when you or I are confronted by darkness and evil, we should stop, be reminded of the scope of what Satan is up to, and then lean on the one who is stronger and who came with the exact opposite missions. Listen, instead of stealing, giving. Instead of killing, giving life. Instead of destroying, making new creations. My friends, you have nothing to fear in Satan because Jesus has nothing to fear in Satan. Then he goes on, "But I came to bring them life and far more life than before." The famous ending of John 10:10, that life to the full, life more abundant. Really, this is one of Jesus' greatest and most famous statements in all the four Gospels. But sometimes I think it's one of the ones we have most robbed of its glory and its depth of meaning. So often, you will hear it spoken about as if, "I came that they might have life, and oh boy, it's a really good, exciting life." But that understanding is qualitative, rather than, as he really means it, quantitative. If he came that we might have life, doesn't that mean necessarily that before him, without him, we actually didn't have life? And after all, how could we have? As John will so beautifully remind us and tell us in 1 John 1, Jesus himself is life. So my friends, Jesus came that we might have Jesus and might have Jesus abundantly, extravagantly. And how can you actually possess something abundantly and extravagantly over and above the simply having it in your midst or with you? By having this life, this Jesus, dwelling within you. Yes. Colossians 1, Christ in you, the hope of glory. That is life, and that is life to the full. Then he goes on, I am the good shepherd. Stop again. Because so quickly we arrive at Jesus' fourth I am statement. Now, with reference to that, cast your mind back to the picture with which Jesus opened this chapter of that sheepfold, the door, the sheep, and the shepherd. Picture that in your mind's eye, because can you see it? For the flock in Jesus' care, for the individual sheep within that flock, Jesus is the door and the shepherd. He is the totality of their existence. He is all that they know or would ever need to know. To go out or in for food or protection, they go through him. To be led out or in, they need only follow him. There is nothing in this life we need that isn't fully met by the door, by the good shepherd, by Jesus himself. We need only know his voice. The good shepherd will give his life for the sake of his sheep. But the hired man, who is not the shepherd and does not own the sheep, will see the wolf coming, desert the sheep, and run away. And the wolf will attack the flock and send them flying. The hired man runs away because he is only a hired man and has no interest in the sheep. I am the good shepherd, and I know those that are mine, and my sheep know me, just as the Father knows me, and I know the Father. And I am giving my life for the sake of these sheep. Jesus here sets up this dramatic contrast between himself, the good shepherd, and this hired man, so that we can see how different are their motivations and the outcomes. The hired man tends the sheep for the rate of his hire. He is motivated to care for these sheep by the money he'll receive for it. But the good shepherd, he loves his sheep, perfectly knowing those that are his and enjoying their knowledge of him simply because he loves them. So when disaster strikes, the hired man will run. But the shepherd fears no disaster. In fact, all along, he is planning to give his life to save his sheep. He has nothing to fear. So again, this shepherd, this Jesus, is the only one whose voice we need to know. Right now, do you know it? Do you know how it sounds? Then he goes on, and I have other sheep who do not belong to this fold. I must lead these also, and they will hear my voice. So there will be one flock and one shepherd. Whew. Now this idea, that there would be a flock that included both Jews and Gentiles, which is really his meaning. Ooh, so audacious, so provocative, that it was probably actually this statement that causes the people, again, to say in verse 19 that he is possessed by a demon. For them, it is simply too much, and this is too far for them to understand. They are certainly not prepared for what he's about to say next. This is the reason why the Father loves me, that I lay down my life, and I lay it down to take it up again. No one is taking it from me, but I lay it down of my own free will. I have the power to lay it down, and I have the power to take it up again. This is an order that I received from my Father. Now, theologically speaking, there is so much going on in these few sentences that if you stop to think about it, it hurts your head. It's like trying to think about eternity. And let me prove it to you. Let's go all the way back. Let's think back to the beginning of man. Because at the creation, Adam and Eve, they walked perfect and perfectly with God. They lived effortlessly in the center and enjoyment of their Father's will. It didn't occur to them, until it was suggested to them by Satan, that their self-will might actually have any interest for them. But in them then exerting it against God, they fell. And we're now forever fallen, with a capital F. The constant presence of the imperfect self-will was now upon them. That was the condition of sin. Well, then, at some point in what we now call time, Jesus was given this order, as he says, from the Father, that it would be his job to then wage war upon the self-will, sin, and Satan. And what would be Jesus' only weapon? To rob sin of its power by every day, every minute of every day, denying the self and walking in the exact will of his Father. I mean, we've already studied this. He plainly says that sort of thing in John 6:38. For I have come down from heaven not to do my will, but to do the will of him who sent me. And my friends, do you understand that he understood this to absolutely include his death? He knew that all along. Hence the cross being the world's most glorious moment, as Jesus' authority to lay down his life perfectly meets with the Father's will to redeem mankind. Do you understand? That was Jesus' most powerful act of self-abandonment. But do you also understand that Jesus was not externally raised from the dead, like he will soon exert a raising upon Lazarus, but that it was his own authority, his own expression of his own will that would cause him to, quote, take up his life again. Oh, do you understand the power of that Friday and that Sunday, Good Friday and Easter? Because you see, the cross was the final abandonment of the self-will, and the resurrection was the most complete exertion of self-will in all human history. That Friday and Sunday gave birth to a new sort of human will, a will totally redeemed from the self and sin. Can you see why I got a little excited about it? All right, let's finish up. Once again, the Jews were in two minds about him because of these words, many of them remarking, "The devil's in him and he's insane. Why do you listen to him?" But others were saying, "This is not the sort of thing a devil-possessed man would say. Can a devil make a blind man see?" To me, I am 100% not surprised that these statements of Jesus caused such a violent outburst and an argument in his hearers. Frankly, where I get surprised more of the time is in how totally unsurprised we're living our lives when we are following one who'd make these kinds of statements in the first place. My friends, aren't you shocked by this half chapter? By the richness of his love, by the audacity of his redemptive plan? Sometimes I get a little fearful that the later church of today has grown to be fairly matter-of-fact about the fact of the matter. The early church had none of that. They were consistently surprised because their lives gave no quarter to any unbelief. How about us? How about you?